This is a Pinball News production.
I'm Melissa Harmon. I'm part of the curatorial staff of the Pacific Pinball Museum. I'm an artist, not really an academic, but I've started looking at pinball art, and there's just so much there. This is just a selection of what could continue to be a bigger show. So it's called Pinball Style, and I'm just going to read the slides. As everyone knows, pinball machines in America were found in joints, hangouts, and hideaways. Pinball was a getaway to freedom and erotic fun without responsibility. Pinball art was thought of as kitsch or in bad taste if it was thought of at all, but pinball players were treated to novel concepts in art and design with each new game. The pinball machine introduced a world of art and invention to small towns across America. This Bally Bumper playfield from 1936 is a beautiful Art Deco example of industrial design with gracefully molded springs. Wearing 30s pageboy hairstyles, smooth as blonde syrup, these dancers carefully hold their bubbles. Burlesque stripper Sally Rand invented the bubble dance in the 1930s. She said, "I wanted a balloon 60 inches in diameter made of a translucent material. Thick rubber target balloons used by the military were the biggest ones available. So Sally hired some experts and had a big pink bubble made to fit her perfectly, hiding only what was necessary." So this pinball machine was probably inspired by Sally Rand. At the close of World War II, the horrors of war were tempered with fantasy as pinball artists began to tell romantic stories. Earlier games were more about design. Then the stories and drama started to come in. These blondes are waiting for the paratroopers to drop back into their lives. Artist George Millenton painted women beautifully coiffed and dressed, some in tailored suits, a hallmark of fine design influenced by military uniforms. So a lot of the early machines were influenced by the military, and tailored fashion became available to more generally public. A pillbox is not a place to store pills, but a round building full of machine guns to hold off the enemy. That's the origin of the name for the pillbox hat worn by the stewardess on the right. So you still have military influence on some of these machines. Control Tower, 1951. Tailored English suits give the companions in purple and green an air of authority. They seem to be conferring about the Angelina Jolie lookalike, whose seductive attitude and relaxed clothing sets her apart from them. So there's definitely a drama going on in this one. Also, England was a source of tailoring to begin with bespoke tailoring, which is a precise system of pattern making developed by Savile Row tailors. Maybe they got it from Chinese, but it's, anyhow, more tailoring in the clothes. I think they're really beautiful suits. This is another George Millenton, Big Ben. The blonde, brunette, and redhead pay no attention to the flaming rocket ships as they languidly dream. Backless, glowing gowns give them a vulnerable beauty. Designer Jean-Louis debuted a strapless evening gown with very low back in 1946. Worn by Rita Hayworth in the film Gilda, the gown had plastic framework with three stays under each breast. So technological design in bras were reflected in a lot of pinball machine art. This is Shoot the Moon. 1940s and 1950s actresses such as Lana Turner and Jane Russell wore tight sweaters to emphasize the bust line. Pedal pushers worn mid-calf were a new invention. Good times and fun are happening as the boys watch the busty beauties. The demure player in the foreground has an impossibly narrow waist. The patterned linoleum and chrome, and the chrome and plastic dinette chair are totally 50s. So it's wonderful historic imagery. Lovely Lucy is a knockoff of I Love Lucy, which aired in 1951. The CBS network did not want Lucy's TV character to be married to a Cuban band leader because it would not be believable. Lucille Ball said, "What do you mean? Nobody will believe it. We're already married." So They were actually married, which was pretty great, you know, well, social things happening at the time. The ruffled and patterned Cuban attire is influenced by flamenco styles of southern Spain, as well as Afro-Cuban and French Creole fashion. And also, there's a lovely Lucy back glass that's being raffled, so come on over and come to the raffle, and you can win a lovely Lucy back glass. The upscale Ivy League students try to look casual in textured fall sweater sets. In the 60s, Burberry clothiers introduced new knitwear designs in wool and cashmere, and it became fashionable to wear multiple patterns in the same outfit. But the young man is definitely trying too hard with his red, white, and blue directional stripes. Maybe he is feeling guilty because he got a college deferment and did not have to go to war in Vietnam. That was what was happening at the time. Campus Queen, 1966. As the clown licks his peppermint stick, his thoughts might be on the delicious costumes of the showgirls, which look like cake icing. Bob Mackey, the famous costumer, could have whipped up these outfits. Ultra-feminine accessories such as the blue and pink lacy necklaces with chains which hold up the bodice of the gown, that's right, and the slim gloves with ruffles at the top complete the look. So this is Bandwagon, 1966. Holding her thoroughbred's rope with long white gloves, she unsuccessfully keeps the horse from eating her friend's hat. Their hats are very chic, especially the hexagonal one. Hats and white gloves are traditionally worn at the Kentucky Derby race held the first Saturday in May at Churchill Downs in Louisville, Kentucky. The happy horse is a study in curved lines and planes. This is Paddock, 1969. So you can see there's class things going on, like upper class, wealthy people. You know, if you're playing pinball, you get to see what it's like at Churchill Downs. Maybe you're living in a small town and you don't know anything about that. So here's Klondike Sam as a fashion icon. The old bronco-riding prospector is dressed for success. His stash of gold nuggets is safe in the Bank of Alaska, and he has come back to the mine to get some more. His Western duds are suitable for leisure or settling grievances with his rivals. If you look at the rest of the glass, they're having a little altercation, and he's falling off his horse. When he's not being thrown by his pink pattern pony, his handmade boots fit marvelously in the stirrups. So this is one of the greatest pinball machines for illustrating a lot of things about American art. Christian Marsh, who came to the United States from France in 1967, brought a European sense of style and combined it with new movements in the American art scene. The artists pictured in Op Pop Pop is painting other artists who are making art themselves and who are surrounded by their own art, which includes hanging mobile and freestanding sculptures and the abstract expressionism of throne paint, op art, and psychedelic art, all in this one pinball machine. You can see that the artist is squeezing paint directly from the tube onto the canvas. And if you go and see the machine itself, there's another artist that's cut off in this picture making a sculpture. They're all dressed and very artistically. It's just quite wonderful. And then this is from the playfield of Op Pop Pop. And she's throwing paint, which is, as she throws paint by the bucket full, the artist is well-dressed for the occasion. The double row of buttons and hint of pleated bustle gives her skirt a bit of military tailoring and a conservative touch. So she's more conservative than ones on the back glass. A layered haircut, geometric jewelry and shoes, pointed geometry of her legs and arms brings order to the wild scene. So there's this combination of the pointy people and then there's psychedelic plastics. Op art, pop art, abstract expressionism, and psychedelia are all referenced. Pop art is considered one of the last modern art movements. Because of her technique, the pictured artist is an abstract expressionist like Jackson Pollock. Pop Pop, 1968. Skin is in, green or whatever color you want. So is having your own pink and orange robot as a fashion accessory. I would like one. In the 70s, the U.S. space program took off. Designers and artists such as Paco Rabanne, Betsy Johnson, Pierre Cardin, and Andy Warhol made clothes from space-age materials such as these studded metals and plastic insets on artist Gordon Morrison's Chubby Robot. What a great time in outer space. Astro, 1971. So this is the second Big Ben. This is the later Big Ben machine. The great bell of the clock tower at the Palace of Westminster in London has been a symbol of reliable and steady British culture. The fashionistas lounging below Big Ben are London youth who rebelled against old boring Britain and began to dress flamboyantly. They were called mods for moderns. Mod clothes had old-fashioned Edwardian tailoring combined with wild patterns. So this is Big Ben, 1975, and as you probably know, the mods had a big influence on fashion in America, and which combined with the hippie movement revolution and just all kinds of things happened. And there are a lot of pinball machines about that, too, which is a whole other story. So wearing slim, short, cuffed bell-bottoms, suspenders, a star-splashed shirt, wool stevedores cap, and huge boots, the pinball wizard looks fantastic in this ensemble. American cartoonist R. Crumb drew large-booted people in the well-known Keep on Truckin' images of 1968. For Tommy, the rock opera, a British artist designed the wizard's boots, modeling them in fiberglass over 4 feet high. His inspiration was cherry red Doc Martens boots. Captain Fantastic, 1975, had a huge influence on fashion for a long time. So as rivalry between the women unfolds, the shooter's fabulous wide lapels and red sleeveless sweater vest dominate the scene. His hairstyle copies French movie stars like Jean-Paul Belmondo. His opponent with a Coco Chanel haircut holds a pool ball in her palm. Is she cheating? Why is she showing the ball to the brunette? What's going on here? She's got a pool ball. She's holding it like that. So another drama is going on. It's always interesting to see. I don't know what's going to happen next. So this is Star Pool, 1974. So this pinball style show is but a small sample of the drama and design to be found in pinball art. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to present my work at the Pacific Pinball Exposition 2010. Happy playing. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Dan Fonts, and I'm one of the mural painters responsible for the murals, the backdrops to the expo. Ron's going to be kind of helping me put this on because I have a little bit of a technological phobia. I also was responsible for helping put the poster together with Mike Sheese for the first 3 years and hopefully next year. I'm just going to read my little introduction here. It's a little awkward because I'm kind of working this up as a theory that may be able to turn into something. So just kind of bear with me. I don't have all the bumps worked out of the road here. So each of the artists you're about to meet shared some of the following traits in common. Most were from small Midwestern towns. You were growing up through the 1930s through the 1960s. Where there was no TV, no internet, fewer telephones, less TV, less radio, or maybe radio could just be for the middle class. One of the entertainments you might do would be to go to a movie night on the weekends, or maybe live theater in the autumn, or a circus in the summer times. Art galleries and artists were seldom, if ever, part of a person's day-to-day world outside of big cities. Running parallel to this period of 1930s to 1960s is the golden age of pinball and jukebox art. But down on the corner, one of the shared cultural bright spots might have been a pinball machine or a jukebox in the five and dime store, the barber shop, or bowling alley, or in the gas station. Often these were places where kids could meet and sneak a peek at the adult world with its overtones of adventure and romance and sex and classy entertainment and perhaps a little bit of excitement. The machines themselves were built in America with solid materials, including hardwoods, high-quality metals. Todd McCullough's calling. Let's see. So anyway, the machines themselves were built in America with solid materials and high-quality metals like copper and nickel-plated chrome and beautiful surfaces, translucent plastics, and jewel-like elements with beveled posts, dependable motors, electronic components that could stand the test of time. The machines were adorned with Art Deco bumper caps, streamlined modern silkscreen art on the playfields, and combined modern styling and the latest tricks and gadgets, bells, knockers. Some of the machines included more double entendre and insider humor than a 10-year-old boy could handle. All were there to be activated for years for the price of a dime. Now, each of these artists shared an interest in creating some fine art, and most of the people I'm presenting here, perhaps with the exception of Charles Bell, reached a borderline legendary status, meaning, you know, they'll probably make a movie about them someday, like Andy Warhol, or and I'm going to just kind of go down the list, and we're starting with Roy Lichtenstein. Everybody's familiar with his art? Has anybody seen his art in person? Anybody? Great. Okay. So the theory I'm developing is that each of these artists are at one point or another, probably in their youth, were touched by pinball to the point where it led them to create works of fine art later in life. And thus, pinball wove itself deeper into the American experience, far more so than just the play Tommy or just the song Pinball Wizard. Some of the works you're about to be seeing, if these are seen in person, can leave a person thunderstruck. For whatever reasons, photography is just not the optimal viewing. However, that's what we're working with today. Photography for me leaves a lot of the works dull and flat and kind of deflavorized compared to a first-hand experience. But because visual art doesn't exhibit the same way, it doesn't have the same sway as pop culture, say, with movies or music. These are extremely well-known artists whose work often commands millions of dollars per painting, and you're not likely to have experienced some of the references that you might. So anyway, let's just move into the first artist here, Roy Lichtenstein. And Roy's work, I kind of related it to the work that you'd see, the superhero images on Superman. In particular, some of these images up here on this pop, this piece of plastic here, they're almost just, you could take a Lichtenstein, shrink it down, and just put it on a playfield practically. But this is some of his other work that you might not be familiar with, but his work generally, you know, he works with two or three really bold colors, you know, these strong edges and this dot pattern. This is typical Lichtenstein work, but his work, as far as I can tell, it's almost wall-sized, which is another reason why I like it, because I tend to paint murals. But anyway, there's this direct correlation, perhaps, between like a Hulk or a Spider-Man and Roy's work. And this is a picture of the artist. I tried to include a picture of the artist so people would see these are actual human beings rather than just some factory cranking these out. So Roy Lichtenstein, he's one of the few. He's actually from New York. I think I hit the wrong button here. So do you know how to move the mouse? And we can move on. His early work dealt with themes of the American West and cowboys and Native Americans. And he was really big on hiding images of comic strip figures. Yeah, let's move on to Robert Indiana. His work, I'm not sure if you can see this. Yeah, let's click that up, make it bigger. Right. Anybody ever heard of Robert Indiana? He's actually, after I saw his work, it became clear to me that I think there's a bigger pinball art connection. He's the guy who did the love stamp back in the 60s. He's known for that style. But if you look at his other work that often sells in the $600,000 up to $1 million range when it comes up to auction, it's all directly related to pinball bumper caps. And you know, these are larger paintings, thickly painted. But you'll notice the type font style and the geometric pattern around that you could practically just shrink that and put it on almost any game from the 1930s or 40s. I'll just kind of page through them. And there's some interesting quotes. If I had more time, I'd really love to get into it. It's just interesting, you know, he's using the word juke, joint, and tilt. And there's just a direct correlation between his work. There's Roy, with big number 9 behind him. But they're almost identical to this style of bumper cap. You see it in games from 1940s and 50s when he was growing up. There's another reference to tilt. So I just thought I'd include some of the machines that Roy might have played when he was a boy. Okay, there's back to love. So if we could jump, Ron, to the next set. The American Dream has been a recurring theme in Robert Indiana's work, and he used it to celebrate and criticize a national way of life in the midst of the gaudy, star-spangled colors of the American Dream. His Dream Number 1 was in the Museum of Modern Art in New York, 1961. Let's see, there was one more thing. Okay, I covered that. All right. So, yeah, we're going to jump here to Wayne Thiebaud. He's a local artist. Have people heard of Wayne? He's of course, you have. Well, here, let me make this a little bit bigger. I just came across this the other day. I thought that was pretty exciting. This is one of Wayne's lesser-known paintings. But I got pretty excited when I saw it. I think of him as the painter of pies. I think I might have turned this off again. Did I? Well, I'm not going to get any technological help here. I'm just going to scroll through a few of his more well-known works of art. This one in particular I really love. It's a front of a, you know, just a corner of a general store. But if you look at them long enough, or maybe I've looked at them too long, they actually start to look kind of like bumper caps to me. But he's definitely interested in what I think we're all relating to is coin ops. And this one in particular is completely fascinating because it takes in, you know, he's almost got a pinball machine on a pedestal with a crank handle, and it's somewhere turning between a slot machine and a jukebox and pinball simultaneously. And he's very interested in things under glass. And I bring your attention also to the angle at which he's painting them. I find that to be very interesting. He isn't directly overhead, and he isn't directly looking this way. He's looking kind of at a three-quarter view, not a bird's-eye view. There's so many interesting quotes, but in particular, I'd say, you know, his work is, he's interested in a blue-collar experience. Another gumball machine by Wang. And I've looked at his work so much now that I think even his landscapes are starting to look like pinball playfield layouts. And again, you know, you've got this three-quarter angle view. You know, there seems to be some kind of a subliminal relationship going on there. There's the artist, Wayne Thiebaud. And, Yeah, I was just really, really knocked out by that. Hey, could I get you to jump to the next one? Yeah, he has an interest in character and presence, definitely an American experience. Cafeteria-style foods, cakes, pies, ice cream, hamburger, hot dogs, club sandwiches. It's all a part of Wayne's world. I have no idea who did this. Anyway, we're looking at... let me skip ahead a little bit. Okay. So anyway, as time goes on, hopefully if people see pinball or art that's related to art, if you could just send information my way. And what I'd like to do is just kind of develop a real encyclopedia of particular pop artists who may have been influenced by pinball. So this is a little out of order. So does anybody recognize this fellow or his artwork? Jasper Johns. Very good. Yeah, in particular, I saw this is an interesting relationship between this painting here and this spinning target. Again, he's working in primary colors with a big graphic sort of look, working with numbers like Robert Indiana. But I think he may have played a little pinball too, so... Well, in particular, I was interested in this because it seemed to have kind of like a spring-loaded shooter here, kind of an arch at the top, and then some drips coming down as these kind of subliminal visual elements. So I like to think of Ed Ruscha as Gas Station Ed. He's from a lot of his work's from Southern California. And in particular, he loves the Phillips 66 gas stations. And sorry about the size of some of these. But I think he has some kind of an interesting relationship, a childhood experience with gas station in particular, with public places, all American subject matter. And I just included these as part of the experience. And there's Ed Ruscha, again a visual artist. I thought I'd throw in truck stop just to have a little bit of that relationship there. And if we could move to the next, okay, Tim. My apologies. This is the first time I've presented this idea kind of out loud. It's almost more of an interesting dinner conversation, but with better. visual elements. So, oh great. Well, anybody recognize this work here? He had a pinball machine here last year. It's William Wiley, correct? I after viewing so much of Roy Parker's art and William Wiley's art, I'm convinced that Wiley's just been a direct humor thief of Roy Parker's. But also, I was a little disturbed when Punball came out, you know, the North Star conversion, you know, and people got kind of obsessed. Wow, you know, this game, it sold for undisclosed amounts, over $135,000, you know, and there was a lot of kind of interest in the excitement of these machines going for that amount. But I didn't know how much of William Wiley's work, previous work that he'd actually done. And when you compare his previous work, like these paintings, to Punball, you know, they're just, in particular, this character shows up in Punball, but it's something that was used from previous, you know, these previous icons that Wiley used. Here's the man with his machine. And the Punball, but if you look at some of his references, like melting ice cabs, and you know, I mean, that's something almost Roy Parker could have written, you know, if Gottlieb had presented him with the idea, you know, like, well, we're going to do something about, you know, global warming, Roy. And he said, yeah, most of Wiley's other work is actually just super detailed, and just there's just so much. And, you know, and I mean, not to dwell on it, but I was almost a little disappointed, you know, because he's known for his quality and his references to so many other artists. And I included this, so, you know, in particular up here, if people are familiar with this, name that game. Trivia question. It's worth a T-shirt or a poster.
Grand Slam.
Thank you. Grand Slam. Well, up here you'll see the big the drum and the word symphony on that drum, and it's just a classic Roy Parker pun, something in the 1950s that he would have just included, you know, his plays on words like worms my eye. So anyway, then that's just something he should be paying royalties on, I think. What's cooking, matey? So anyway, but that's more of a recognizable William Wiley painting. He has a great piece down in Hayward at the Centennial Hall, I think, a huge mural like the size of this wall, and it's just something that just took months and months. It's just utterly beautiful. Love his work, but this is probably something more typical of Wiley's work. All right, if we could move on. Okay. I think what I'd like to do is just kind of like cut out one or two of these artists. Unfortunately, I know you're all in rapture about this, but I think there's actually a little bit of a thread. You know, there's something between the childhood experience of some of the artists I'm talking about and the lifetime of creation. You know, I'd like to jump to one guy, George Siegel, if you could.
Number seven.
There he is, in the corner of Siegel. And then we'll do Keenholz, and that'll bring it to an end. I'm just going to, thanks so much, Ron. I'm just going to kind of click through. Has anybody ever heard of George Siegel? Anybody? He's a well-known sculptor. He does kind of these ghosty white figures, but he'll put them in an environment, you know, and they're called installation artworks. And they will install these in museums, but he has this, you know, in a way, instead of using paint or sculpting in bronze, for instance, he's brought to life these figures in kind of a white plaster, but completely recreated the environments of public spaces that we might have all shared back in the 1950s. And in particular, I kind of glommed onto him because many years ago I saw a picture of a piece that he had done where he had a person playing a pinball machine, you know, where he, you know, and they were playing a Gottlieb's wishing well. And it just really kind of, you know, when you see it and you see it, you know, you kind of can't forget it, you know, in particular somebody like me. And unfortunately, this doesn't show it very well, but right over here is the actual Gottlieb wishing well pinball machine, and he's sculpting the head of that. And if anybody ever comes across that, I've looked on the internet, I can't find it, but I think that would just be a great reference point. There's Gottlieb's wishing well, but if you see if you pay attention to the arc where the 7 million is, you can, well, I can't even see it from here, unfortunately, but believe me, it's there. Ron, if we could just click to Ed Keenholz's work. Are there any children in the room? Good. Okay. Well, he's right here, number 9. And I'd love to talk about Charles Bell too. But Ed Keenholz is also an installation artist. He was born in Fairfield, Washington. His kind of one of his unfortunate claims to fame at a 1966 show at the Los Angeles County Museum. It drew considerable controversy over his assemblage. Anybody heard of Backseat Dodge, 1938? Anybody heard of that? Yeah, it's kind of a raw figure. I'm going to show you a picture of it, so brace yourselves. But I like these because, you know, they actually include something that's maybe a little circus-related, a little carnival-related. Here's a color, much better color photograph of this whole sort of parade down Main Street of America. Here's backseat 38 with the drippings on the window. And unfortunately, I couldn't get a better picture of it, but it's kind of a truncated blue car with two figures sort of making out in the back seat. God forbid we should actually have a reflection of the American experience. This piece in particular is also wonderful. He's recreated the entire bar, and instead of faces, people have clocks, four faces. It's just really fantastic. And here's this small merry-go-round that he's created and has replaced the figures around, but very ornate. These are huge installations that just took years. He did these with his wife and insisted that his work be referred to as Keenholz. Like, oh, that's a Keenholz, but that would refer to both him and his wife. Oops, went backwards. I thought everybody loved seeing this, the Playboy machine with a woman's legs sticking out in front, and is a bronze game that's actually in... where is this? It's called Bronze Pinball Machine with Woman Affixed Also, from 1980. And it says here that the curatorial assistant, Ben Sibin, is the current record holder with 820,000 points. And try to beat that, you know. Anyway, and that can be found in Rotterdam in the this show called Wit de Wit in the climax room. Then here's another piece of Keenholz work. It's kind of shocking, but again, working in public spaces, doing big installation artwork that, you know, could take up 40, 50 feet of space. And here's a picture of Keenholz, and there's just, I hope I have time to, how am I doing, 2 minutes or something? There's just this great piece at the end. It says, Keenholz died in Idaho in June of 1994 from a heart attack while hiking in the mountains. He was buried, and this is a quote, his corpulent embalmed body was wedged into the front seat of a brown 1940 Packard coupe. There was a dollar and a deck of cards in his pocket, a bottle of 31 Chianti beside him, and the ashes of his dog Smash in the back. He was set for the afterlife, to the whine of bagpipes. The Packard, steered by his widow Nancy Redden Keenholz, rolled like a funeral barge into the big hole. And then it says, I love this. He says his truck used to have Ed Keenholz, expert, painted on the door. It says you might not trust Roy Lichtenstein to frame a shed or Jasper Johns to weld a railing, but Keenholz was doing that stuff since childhood, said Robert Hughes. So anyway, thank you everybody for your patience, and I hope you enjoyed that.